We like to talk about the Emancipation Proclamation. That's what we call this, right? Emergency Medicine Remix is the Emancipation Proclamation for Health. We talk about liberating people from slavery, the slavery of chronic disease and exploitation, the slavery from physical human trafficking and the like. But the truth is, slavery was not eradicated. What we did in the United States is we freed some, we took the physical shackles off of the African slave, but we exported it basically offshore. The conditions that the Rohingya, the conditions that the Uyghur, the conditions that many of the sweatshop factories that are U.S. corporate sponsored and supported are equivalent to slave-like conditions.
Yeah.
People living, 100%. You know, several people to a small room, limited one meal. They can't get up and leave on their own. They're getting paid, if anything, only in just stuff that puts food on the table barely. So we just basically made slavery offshore.
100%. And, you know, and,
so we have to, we have to acknowledge that. You know, I'm all about Black Lives Matter, but I'm about freedom and self-determination for all people. And like Martin King said, a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So sing it, man. Raise the flag, raise the banner.
And you know, and that's, I think we talked about this before too. Like, you know, of course, like Black lives are important. And I think that's the thing. But I think if we just focus on just one group, I think, of who are being suppressed, I think it's this level of hypocrisy, right? And so we have to kind of, I think that's the whole thing, that I think Black Lives Matter has this movement to kind of course, 100%. Put that message out there. You know, it's years and years of oppression. Like you're saying, it was physical oppression initially, right, with the slavery and stuff. But now it's economic, social chains that are being attached to Black population, the Latino population. You know, surprisingly, I mean, I know a lot of people kind of, you know, the typical stereotype for us brown people is two kind of stereotypes, so that we're the very well off, we're the doctors, the lawyers, the engineers, but they're also the cab drivers, the 7-Eleven guys, right? So we kind of fall in those things. And those, you know, we're in as a group, we are a relatively poor, well-off group, but also a relatively poor group as well too. So we have this economic, social chains that are put on us. And so, you know, and that's, you know, the funny things with the Rohingya Muslims is funny because I can never say her name, but the chancellor of Burma or Myanmar actually won the Nobel Peace Prize back in the day when she was house arrest and stood up for China and things like that. But she is completely dumb, silent about the flight of the Rohingya Muslims, right? And it's just the irony, right? That this is a woman who got, I think, but it's basically allowing this massacre and injustice to happen, right? And so it's, I mean, it's like you're saying, it's 100% complicated. I mean, like, you know, Pakistan's biggest ally in the world is China, and Pakistan tends to be put the second or third biggest Muslim country in the world. And you know, and the current prime minister right now, Pakistan is honestly considered to be like an Obama figure. After years of corrupt figures right now in Pakistan, you have Imran Khan, who's a former cricket player. Cricket player who my brother actually met when we were lived in Pakistan for a year. But like, you know, he's supposed to be this guy who's going to change the country. He's changed, doing pretty well in changing the country so far. But he's talking about how, you know, Modi and the Indian military has gone to Kashmir, which is a heavily Muslim area that's fought bomb between India and Pakistan. Right. Went to the UN, talking about justice for the Kashmiris, you know, but has not said anything about the Uyghur Muslims, right? Because it's a tough situation to be in. And it's super complicated, right? I mean, you see these majority Muslim countries, not one has said anything to China about the flight of the Uyghur Muslims, right? Yeah. So it's your 100%. I mean, same thing. I mean, like, you know, we're talking about NBA, like the same thing happened to LeBron James, right? LeBron James is such a big figure talking about Black Lives Matter with Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, all that stuff. But where was he when the protests were happening in China? You know, like he was completely mum about it because again, it just, China's a big economic thing that has money in a lot of things.
And I'm going to put my old man glasses on again because we're going to break this down a little further. This is good stuff. This is good stuff. That is the problem with identity politics. Mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with identity politics, but we have a tendency to use individuals of certain demographics as if they're the sole spokespersons. They're the sole litmus and measuring stick about everything about that matter, us included. This conversation at this table is just a small facet of this experience of being Black, being brown, being Christian, being Muslim, being a New Yorker, being a Virginian, being in Georgia now. It is a small slither, and we should not be given the power to say who's valuable and who's not valuable solely. Mm-hmm. That is a group decision that everybody has to be included in. Hence, yeah. Guess who's coming to dinner? That's why this is an open table. Mm-hmm. We cannot say that, like, oh, you know, John represented for the brothers and sisters. I represented for some of the brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
You know, Jawad represented for some of the brothers and sisters of the faith. He represented for some of them. LeBron mm-hmm. represented for, you know, some of the brothers and sisters in the name of social justice, but just some of them. We cannot yeah. let people be the sole voices. It must be a commonality of all our voices. We got to be willing to listen to people who aren't heard, the people who mm-hmm. aren't seen. And hopefully this is what we're trying to approximate at this table. Guess who's coming to dinner? Oh, I didn't know that we're going to have XYZ coming to this table. We're going to have, realistically, I'm going to bring some transgender people to this table. Why? Yeah. Because that is a voice that I haven't listened to. It's a voice that is new to me. It's a 100%. Voice that people in this audience need to hear. You know, we're mm-hmm. going to have people of different faith, and we don't always have to agree with each other to give each other the value of humanity and respect. So 100%. When you know, when people are preaching Black Lives Matter, that doesn't mean that white lives don't matter, that blue yeah. lives don't matter. You know, we don't have to say all lives matter. We don't have to devalue someone to give ourselves mm-hmm. value. But at the same time, let's be willing to give each other value, to sometimes you know, extend the argument. So I didn't understand how the LGBTQTIA, and I think I got all those right, plus community, seem in so many ways to co-opt the civil rights movement until I really began to listen. I'm like, oh, this is a human rights movement. Yeah. My brothers and sisters in South Africa, it was easy for me to see because they had brown skin, how their plight yeah. was similar to mine in civil rights. But I didn't recognize how it was similar to those in mm-hmm. Asia, yeah. Myanmar, or Burma. Mm-hmm. I didn't recognize how it was similar to some of my brothers and sisters that are actually religiously suppressed in Northern Europe, how it was mm-hmm. similar to those in Brazil. I didn't mm-hmm. understand how, you know, there were all these people that have a commonality of oppression, suffering, and injustice. So once you start marching on your, you know, rights for my people, you got to start eventually doing the rights for all people. And that's what got yeah. King killed. He mm-hmm. took the civil rights argument to a poor people's argument. He went into an anti-war argument. He was like, shoot, I can't just fight for Black people in America. I got to fight for people in Southeast Asia who are being oppressed. Yeah. So you know, you brought out dessert, you know, when you did that. You added yeah. another course to the meal, man. So, that, no, you're exactly right. That's good stuff. Yeah. That's good stuff. Yeah. So I brought up Europe. And mm-hmm. I brought up, you know, how their sufferings are, and that wasn't on purpose. It was just a natural segue. Yeah. Tell me about, you know, the face mask bans in Europe, some of the hypocrisy and contradictions in that.
So this is the irony. So, I mean, I think one of the things I really liked about America was that I think it's pretty diverse. And I think even being Muslim, you know, like we're facing some pressure, but you never were told how to act or dress, or you don't see any laws right now. They're saying banning a woman from wearing burqa and things like that. So within the Islamic faith, right? I mean, the biggest thing was to say kind of, hey, you know, modesty is pretty important. Cover the hair, you know, body and things like that. But there's always a debate about the face, right? Covering the face here. And so I think it's more of a cultural component than more of a religious component, but it's something that kind of course, I think sometimes culture and religious lines kind of blend in together, right? And
so, always.
And so in Europe, you have a huge Muslim population there. And so a lot of the women tend to do, like where I speak from Arab countries and stuff, kind of wear the burqa with the niqab, which is the face veil. And so France has been doing it for a very long time. Belgium is now on board of it, where it's kind of they want to ban the niqab, the face veil, right? That's the women should not be wearing face veil. And the irony is, from what I remember last time I read recently, is that now that it's COVID, you have to wear a mask, right? A face mask. And it's like, you know, joke, I was telling you before, the joke is like Muslim women who wear the niqab were doing this for a very long time, you know, where they're covering their face to protect, right. I guess, protect themselves. But the funny thing is that if a woman wears, in France, if a woman wears a face veil, her fine is higher than a person who's not wearing a mask for COVID. And so that's the irony. Yeah, so it's irony, right? So, I mean, I joke with my wife, like my wife wears a headscarf, but sometimes, ironically, one of her face masks that she wears for COVID and stuff actually matches her hijab sometimes. So she looks like she's wearing a face veil, right? So we joke, like, oh my God, you're one of the, I hope this is not offensive, but I call them ninjabis, right? Like they wear the face veils and stuff, right? So they kind of,
And if it is offensive, we apologize, but you know, it's not the first time you've been offended. Extend us some grace. You've offended people in your lives before too. So don't front on us. All right.
So it's just a joke. I don't mean it in that way, in a ill way, but I mean, that's the thing. Like it's just the irony is that this pressure is to, hey, you got to stop wearing the face veil, but you have to wear a mask to cover your face. But if you wear a face veil, like a niqab, you're going to get a higher fine than somebody who would. And it's kind of irony because, you know, one of the things that, you know, I always tell people, my favorite city in the whole world where I love to travel, but it's London. And for some reason, and I feel like it's London was kind of a place where you have a huge Muslim population, a huge Pakistani population. And I think, you know, like when we went there, we fit in. Like sometimes we travel somewhere because my wife wearing a headscarf, like we did get a lot of stares. But in England, we didn't really get much of that stares. But the irony is that, you know, same thing with France, like, you know, but like there is still anti-Islamic sentiments there, you know, but in France and Belgium, it's a huge, huge push for secularism. So no kind of, you know, but to me, it's kind of ironic because I feel like secularism would be kind of, hey, you kind of prevent anybody, it's kind of, you just be, right? It doesn't matter what you wear, what you do, just, but, you know, but I think it's fun. It's really ironic that this huge push for wearing a mask, but not the face mask, you know? So
right. I don't know. Right. So I like to term those as moralities of convenience.
Yeah.
Your morality and your rationales change based on what works for you. Right. Yeah. So, absolutely. You know, if you're, you know, we brag about a lot of these places being places of religious freedom, but if you're not allowing a person to express their faith and it's not, you know, basically imposing anything, physical harm or anything on anyone else, is that religious freedom? If I say that, oh yeah, this place, you can do whatever you want. We're about liberty and freedom, which France, you know, it stoles all the time, but you just can't practice your faith openly. Yeah. Then you got to question, oh, it's freedom to a point. And that's the whole thing. The concept of freedom is a mindset. It is a, it is relative to what people are willing to allow you to do and what they're willing to impose on you to restrict those things. So yeah, that's deep. That is, I didn't know that. That is deep.
It's completely ironic, you know? And so, but I mean, again, like in France and in a lot of these European countries, you got to remember this, you know, Africa being right near there, you had a lot of African refugees who tend to be Muslims from the, especially on the north part of Africa.
Right, North Africa, right?
So, so I think that's this. There's this anti-immigrant, anti-Islam, Islamic mindset, and so like you have figures in France like Marie Le Pen, who are part of the nationalist movement to kind of prevent to perpetuate Islamophobia. So you can say, hey, like maybe banning face veils, right? Banning immigration from happening to make the country better. But I mean, I think just like same sentiment here, if you think about economically, like a lot of the day labor, Hispanic day laborers are doing jobs that Americans don't want to do, right? And so I think that's what we see these Muslim population that's coming to European countries, they're getting jobs that most French people or Europeans don't want to do. So how do you sustain an economy where you don't have people who are doing those jobs, you know, and they're taking, so when you have people taking over these jobs, maybe it is kind of fueling the economy a little bit, you know? And so,
it is a contradiction, and it's funny, especially during a time where now masks are considered, you know, potentially life-saving or, you know, one of the pillars of prevention for COVID in this case. So now it's permissible, and actually in places are fining for not wearing masks, you know, in that case. If and when that begins to loosen up some, will they then consider, you know, the niqab a threat for religious reasons, or will they see it as the same practicality as it had for, you know, during the pandemic? And so that, you know, they're gonna have to explain that contradiction, you know. You know, but once again, a morality of convenience, I'm sure, will rise to the top. Now you were gonna school me on something. I think it's Omar Ibn Said.
So basically, so it's kind of an interesting story. I think a lot of people think when they think of Muslims, think about Pakistanis, Arabs, things like that. But I think the first Muslims that came to America were the slaves, right? And so when they came in from Africa, and so one of the most, so again, Khalid Beydoun is a figure that I really like. And he wrote a book called Antebellum Islam. And so it kind of talked about how during the slave
Who wrote the book?
Khalid Beydoun, the same
he
guy
also wrote
American Islamophobia.
Gotcha. And thank you. I just want people to be able to pick this stuff up and so they can read. And we'll put this on a website, guys, so you guys can get this and educate yourselves.
Please check those books. I was just kind of phenomenal books. And so kind of spoke about how the first Muslims that came in were black. And so one of the big figures was Omar bin Sayyid, who actually was a scholar from Senegal and was a Muslim scholar, Islamic scholar. That was his job, basically being a theologian. And so came here as a slave, and so he was considered a threat because he was literate. Like, he knew how to write, he knew how to do those things. So was considered a threat, but the thing was for him to kind of survive, he had to convert to Christianity. And so there's a whole debate with scholars now, like, was he truly a convert? Like, was he truly Christian, or was he just a Muslim who's pretending to be Christian in order for survival? And they went through a lot of his documents and stuff, and it was kind of showing how he had a lot of Quranic verses referring to the Prophet, praising the Prophet, and basically kind of giving insight. So we don't know, is he now a conglomeration? You got to remember, like, in a lot of Christian theology is very important to Islamic theology as well too, right? Because we're kind of an extension of Christianity. I kind of joke around, you know how you had Judaism with the Torah, and then you had the Bible is considered the New Testament. So the Muslim mindset is like, because in our belief is like that Muhammad was the last prophet. And so Islam became the Quran became the final testament, right? So like we're, so it's just a continuation.
It is. So nothing comes from itself, you know, and whether you subscribe to the children or the offshoots is actually a deeper discussion and not really the purpose of this discussion today, but we will hope that you guys will continue this, and we're going to come back and circle back. But even the faith debate, nothing forms out of in a vacuum. That's what I should say.
I mean, about
Christian Mormons come out of the. They believe that they're the Latter Day Saints that comes out of Christian texts. You know, if you're Zoroastrians, they believe they were the first monotheists, and that you know all Judaism comes out of that of their monotheistic faith. These are common grounds that we can sit down and break bread and sit at the table and talk to each other, even though we don't worship the same God. In theory, we can still have conversations about what connected us in history. So and that's what we're doing today, man. You know, we can love and respect each other because of that. So tell me, you know, so they believe this, and I know his story. They believe that maybe he may have just been adopting Christianity as a survival mechanism. It may have been something that was a hybrid. As you said, we are extensions from each other. So continue on. Tell me a little bit more.
Yeah, so it's kind of, kind of an interesting story, like about his survival of you know, antebellum America, where slavery was huge. And I think kind of from there, and if you read the book American Islamophobia, kind of continues talking about the whole history of Islam in America. And so I think people keep thinking about, hey, like it's gonna be the brown person, it's gonna be an Arab person that's Muslim, but it's truly, and I think that's why in black culture I think Islam is very important, right? If you listen to a lot of hip-hop, there's a lot of referral to a lot of Islamic allusions and stuff. There's you know, Nation of Islam, you have the, I think the 5%ers, right? Like all these things kind of coming out of Islam. And so you kind of look through, you know, and it's kind of interesting too, like where, you know, the first, like citizenship too for Muslims didn't kind of happen until like the 1940s. So think about how long America was a country for. And I think that's the thing, like it's a group of people that we don't really focus on, because we make like what, 1.1% of the population. We're tiny, very tiny. We're not politically important right now. I'm saying now, I think we'll definitely be in the future, because I think if you think about Islam, it's probably the fastest growing religion in the world and in America.
You beat my statistic. I was about to say that Islam actually is the fastest growing faith in the world.
Yeah.
Right now, right?
And I think it is going to ultimately become a very important political group soon. But it's kind of interesting because, like, you know, I think the first, you know, and it's so funny, at that time, they thought that being Muslim was basically being equivalent to being black, right? So it's basically, you know, there was the first Arab who got citizenship was a Syrian Christian, because he was white and Christian. Now he's white, right? So I know a lot of Muslims trying to get citizenship at that time, but they weren't getting it because they were not considered white. And so it wasn't until 1940s when Saudi Arabia and America started having a very good relationship that, you know, all of a sudden now Saudis were getting citizenship now whether it comes to America. And slowly in the 60s, they tried to open up immigration to kind of make America seem inclusive. So get the smart guys. That's where the engineers came in, the PhD students came in. And that's what kind of, I think you see this now melting pot in America. But I think one of the most important things I do want to kind of say is kind of, we're talking about being a small population group. I think we're not a population that's very, we're not geared towards when it comes to politics, right? When Biden went down to South Carolina with James Clyburn, like getting the black population, you know, getting the Latino population in Florida, but nobody's going, hey, let's go focus on the Muslim population. I think one of the kind of important things I want to say too is if you combine Obama's 8 years with Trump's mm-hmm. 4 years, they only went to a mosque twice. You know, two times. That's it, two times. And it was Obama both times.
And remember, Obama, by some people's political stance, was supposed to be Muslim, right?
Right. I mean, right. He is Muslim right now, but he's not. But like, it's funny because Osama. See, I messed up. I do the same thing that Fox News does. But like, Obama basically went in 2008, was at Al-Azhar University, which is one of the biggest Islamic universities in the world, in Cairo, in Egypt. And so he went there. And for us, a lot of Muslims, like, whoa, a U.S. president going there and talking about how, you know, that we're all one people and things like that. And so that's why I think a lot of Muslims drew to Obama. But the thing was so interesting with Obama, like he never went again until the very end in 2015 when he went to the mosque in Washington, D.C., but his tone kind of changed a little bit. And I think that's what a lot of people tend to be very, you know, I know Kay Ford mentioned his number 44 and things like that. But, you know, me personally, I have my critiques of him because initially I was in that bandwagon where I was like, hey, like, you know, like, wow, he's a different figure. He's going to change things. But in 2015, he went to Washington, D.C. and basically gave a talk to the Muslims there, basically telling us to surveil each other. Again, in that sentiment, saying that we're very, I guess, again, that thing, like we're violent people, that we're dangerous, so you got to monitor yourself. And then, again, Trump has never been to a mosque, right? But I think that's what you've seen in American politics currently, too. I think a lot of us are drawn to Bernie Sanders because, like, in 2 days in Detroit, he went to 7 different mosques, right? Like, his, you know, campaign posters and things were in Arabic and Urdu and Persian, things like that to kind of draw towards the Muslim population.
And but if you believe just all that, if one person represents a faith or two people represent a faith, you're supposed to be sworn enemies if you believe that narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Right? Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
Jewish, you know, Muslim, they're not supposed to be, you know, allies. But so I'm glad to hear you say that just to show how non-monolithic we are. So you said,
absolutely.
You know, you like this, the message and actually the action, not just what he was saying, but the fact that he was making a bridge to come to speak.
Yeah. Right. And I think the interesting thing about kind of, you know, we kind of, hey, finally there's a figure that's kind of looking out for us. Right. And so, but it's interesting with Obama too, with interesting things, I don't know if people know this, but actually drone attacks in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan actually increased when Obama was,
through
president.
Through drone strikes and
and so
some special ops initiatives. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah, and so went up, right? And you'd be surprised, a lot of people would think like, hey, maybe George Bush would be the one who'd be doing it, or Trump would be doing it, but it was actually during Obama's presidency that it went up. But the interesting thing was, if you look at the death tolls, like they seem falsely low because they considered women and children as collaterals who died. But any men, even though they were innocent, if they were of adult age, they were considered combatants. And so that's what at the end it would look false. I mean, hey, we got a lot of combatants. But the things, even though the age was like, say, if it was me, I'm 33, and I say I was just at home chilling with my family and boom, a drone attack killed me. I had no involvement if anything that's any terrorist organization. But at the end of the day, like I would be considered a combatant because I was an adult male.
Let me spin that. And I don't say spin that. I don't mean spin that in for any propaganda reasons, but we've talked about the commonality of our experiences and we talk about the commonality of our experiences when it comes to health, justice, and all those things. That's what we do on this platform. But what you just said to me struck me as not a false moral equivalent, but a true moral equivalent. Is that not different than what we are upset about with Breonna Taylor? Mm-hmm. That you have this authoritarian force seeking to stamp out evil and in the attempt of sometimes overstretching its or overreaching, it goes and then kills innocent people in the name of justice, in the name of righting wrongs, and yet there's no accountability for it. Isn't that very similar? Isn't that a common experience?
100%. You know, and things that, you know, it's funny, like with Breonna Taylor's case, actually, like if you look at the civil case, like the family got a lot of money, like they got a lot of money out of it. But when it came to this population in the Middle East and Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And we're not saying that money is the reason that everything's all right. But you look at the equivalent that you're saying that doesn't happen.
Yeah. And so you see, but I mean, but what the US government was doing was giving for a family that had, say, had five people pass away, they would give $500 per person. So now you're putting like a monetary terms, like that's, well, in the Middle East, this population, is one life just worth $500, right? And it's, and, but I mean, it's also in like an American justice system. You see, like, you know, black individuals who were wrongly imprisoned, and when they kind of, you know, sued, you know, the county or the state that's there, but they get so much less money than compared to their white counterparts, right? When they were falsely imprisoned and accused. But it's just kind of, you know, I think this is a reality that we don't see. I think it's something that, again, we're just in our little bubble. I mean, even, you know, it's kind of funny, when I was at Emory, like when the George Floyd case happened, like one of the pharmacists was telling me, like, who's white. She's like, I never knew this happened. Because I think we just live in this bubble, right? And so I think that's, we don't see this, right? Because again, our population, I truly believe that our population is a very, is ignored population, because again, we're so small that, you know, we just make one, like I said, again, 1.1% of the population. So we're not going to stand out. We're not a politically relevant group. So we're not going to make headways. I mean, just look, I mean, like you had Keith Ellison, you had Andrea Carson, were one of the first Muslims to be in the Congress. But now the funny thing is, you have two pretty vocal women who are in the House right now with Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, but they're really like maligned, you know, for, I think, again, being Muslim, being women, being considered anti-Semitic because of the critique of Israel, and things like that, where it's like, again, the sentiment is still fresh. And, you know, like the opponents are using Islamophobia as a way of trying to get at them, to try to defeat them. And so, you know, I don't think you see like black people doing that with black politicians or with Latino populations. Like, hey, like they're using, I mean, I'm sure they can use certain tropes, but they're kind of subtle tropes, I guess, but not as an outwardly saying, hey, these are anti-Semitic people, they're Muslims. Look, Ilhan Omar wears a headscarf and things like that. And so questioning them.
Say it again. Say your question. You say you don't see people doing it with black politicians, you're saying that where they tropes.
I think they definitely are using tropes, but I personally haven't. I mean, maybe because I'm not paying attention or not, but like not to like, hey, like this person is lazy because they're black or they're this. You know what? Like the sentiments or something. But I think when you see with Ilhan Omar, you're saying, hey, this is, you know, like she's wearing a headscarf. She's, you know, saying anti, you know, sentiments, like anti-Israeli sentiments. Now they're sure she's anti-Semitic, like using that against her, in a way, you know. So.
And I will tell you this. Yeah, let me tell you this. I would push back that.
Yeah,
you see those, whatever they believe will work, right?
Yeah.
If a dog responds to a dog whistle, you respond with the dog whistle. If a dog responds to a bark or a clap, your dog, you know, you yell at the dog or you clap or you do the clicker if you train animals. And when you're looking at people who are trying to rally troops in the name of prejudice and hate, they'll use, but you know, they like Malcolm said, they'll use by any means necessary. I remember during the Obama administration, they would say, oh, you know, when Michelle and Barack would do a fist bump, they're like, oh, was that some type of, you know, Muslim handshake and how he hates the Jews. And I remember those tropes, not because they thought those, simply because they thought they were Muslim. People will use whatever tool they can to split people, to demonize people. And I think that the convenient tool, or the tool that's most obvious based on longstanding prejudices and fears, are the ones people grab first. You know, and say, I'm going to grab a gun to shoot you before I grab a, you know, an axe. Can you get killed with an axe? Yeah, but it's not efficient. So they know that when it comes to Ilhan Omar and, you know, shoot, you don't have to be, you know, AOC. When you talk about these people, she's, you know, Latina. When you talk about how they're going to alienate people, we grab those things. And that's on any side of any argument. It is unfortunate, but you know, so you're right. They're grabbing easy targets because we know we got a longstanding history of those prejudices against, you know, people of that faith.
And you know, one of the interesting kind of say, especially with the current politics, and I kind of mentioned, I think in our gun bars talk, whereas when Michigan went under lockdown and you had those, like the right
militia
kind of came in with the guns and things like that. And there's one picture where they're all sitting in the back of pickup trucks, you know, these guys. But it's funny, like the same, if it was a guy with a beard, darker shade, wearing some traditional clothing from my side of the world, Again, we're terrorists, we're things like that. But these guys were considered patriots, right? So, I mean, the irony there. And the other ironic part is kind of, if you've, you know, like I haven't seen it much being covered in the news. I mean, I don't watch the news as much anymore because it's too depressing. But kind of see this stuff in like social media where, remember when you had these in Europe and even like, I think it was in Ohio where the student, like Muslim kids or the individuals were used cars and trucks as a means of hurting people, like, you know, driving over people as and it was labeled as terrorism. But you're seeing this right now where you have Black Lives Matter protesters are going out there and then you have cops or you have these Trump supporters going and they run, trying to run over people there. But like, there's no mention of them being terrorists or any kind of crazy ramification that's happening. Right. I mean, it just kind of perpetuates things, the actions even more because it's being condoned. Right. So I just think it's the ironic part when it's us behind the wheel, it's an issue. Right. But when it's them at the end, it's just because like, and I said this before too, if I was this guy in Michigan or wherever, I walked in with a freaking gun with an AK-47 into a courthouse, like I would be freaking shot right there.
Oh yeah. So, you wouldn't even get up the steps. I'd
be done. No. Right. So, but that, you know, that was a problem,
Yeah. And that's what we want people to see. This common thread. So the difference between a freedom fighter, a patriot, and a terrorist is the person who's telling the story.
100%.
I mean, now, are there some universally righteous causes amongst those three categories I just kind of artificially built up? Yeah, there are. Mm-hmm. But it depends on who's telling the story, whether they're willing to understand that. You know, the Boston Tea Party, they dressed up like indigenous people. They hopped on a boat. They sank capital. Sounds similar. Sounds like burning and looting, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And yet they're seen as fathers of this country, right? They're seen as patriots. They're seen. You have people who are in their homeland, in their homes, carrying guns and fighting invaders who are looking for something that's not even in their country, weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. And they're seen as terrorists. Mm-hmm. What is more terrifying than having someone kick down your door, shoot your family, drop bombs on you from nowhere, and for something that you know and really they even know that it doesn't even exist there? However, their story is not often told. It's us writing the story. So it's a matter of perspective. Mm-hmm. You know. So when you talk about people are protesting, I don't believe it's right to burn down and loot. Was that not what happened to First Nations and Native Americans when the colonists first got here? Mm-hmm. You don't call them terrorists. We call them colonists. Settlers, but they're terrorists. So we must be willing and humble enough to say that, hey man, I know I see myself as righteous in this call, but from your perspective, I'm not righteous. Hey, you may see me as a bad guy, but do you realize the righteous cause that I'm standing up for is the same as yours, defending my own freedom, my own safety, my family, and those things? So you hit it right on the head, man. You hit it right on the head. And so kid me, because all right, now you're getting hot. You're getting hot. You're gonna make your dad sad because you're lighting this up now. So you know, the relations with Israel. You know, we're not asking you to be an expert on this, but you know, you experience it. Just give us a different perspective between the Palestinian and Israeli conflict.